Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Keeping your IT team sharp isn't optional, it's essential. CBT Nuggets delivers high quality IT training led by real world experts who know what teams actually need on systems teams will actually use. Whether it's staying current on cloud, networking, or security, CBT Nuggets makes training simple, effective, and scalable. No fluff, no wasted time, just smarter, faster IT teams. Thousands of companies trust CBT Nuggets, and yours can too. Go to cbtnuggets.com/solutions and start training today.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. On the evening of January 14, 1990, Doug Sile knocked on the front door of Mercer House, a grand 19th-century mansion facing Monterey Square in Savannah, Georgia. The man who lived there hadn't been returning calls. Sile, who knew the routines of the house well, let himself in. Inside, nothing initially seemed out of place. The Mercer House was always immaculate, filled with furniture both antique and modern, painstakingly selected by its wealthy owner. To people who asked about his process, and plenty did, he'd say it was simple. He chose things he wanted to spend time looking at. Sile paid those precious items no mind as he walked through the eerily quiet home. When he reached the study, he saw the body of a man lying on the floor. It wasn't moving. Sile called for help, but by the time emergency services arrived, it was too late. James Arthur Williams, one of Savannah's most celebrated preservationists, its most talked about host, and not so long ago, its most famous criminal defendant, was dead at 59. Williams had been at the center of a legal drama that transfixed the city for nearly a decade. He had been tried not once, not twice, but 4 times for the same crime. The only person in Georgia history to face 4 murder trials for a single incident. His case exposed the fault lines in Savannah's social structure and raised questions that still echo through the city's manicured squares and moss-draped oaks. To some, Jim Williams was a visionary. He restored more than 30 historic buildings, including the Old Pink House, the Hampton Lillibridge House, and, of course, the Mercer House itself. He amassed a world-class collection of antiques and transformed his home into a kind of private museum, throwing parties that attracted politicians, aristocrats, and the elite of Savannah society. To others, Williams was arrogant, controlling, and morally ambiguous, a man who played by his own rules and made powerful enemies along the way. But whatever people thought of him, no one could ignore him. Especially not after May 2, 1981. That night, in the very same study where his body was found nearly 9 years later, Williams shot and killed 21-year-old Danny Hansford, a volatile young man who worked for him and, it would be revealed, had also been involved with him personally. Williams claimed the shooting was self-defense. Police and prosecutors weren't so sure. The case became a media spectacle and a local obsession. It went to trial not once, but 4 times, each more contentious than the last. By the end, the city was divided, exhausted, and obsessed in equal measure. Jim Williams returned to Savannah a free man, legally cleared, but never quite untouched. Less than a year later, he was gone. News of his death rippled through the city. Some were shocked, others weren't. No one said much publicly, but behind closed doors, the questions came easily. Was it really over? Was there more to the story? Was it possible that Savannah's most complicated man hadn't just died in that house, but had been silenced? Of course, there's a simpler explanation, but we're not there yet. Because this story isn't just about Jim Williams. It's about the death of Danny Hansford and everything that death set in motion. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Galatea. You know that moment when you finally get 5 quiet minutes to yourself and your phone is just begging you to doom scroll?
Yeah, that's when you sneak off and open Galatea instead.
Exactly. Galatea is a reading app with a huge library of romance stories. Whether you're into shifter romance, forbidden love, bad boy billionaires, or slow burn fantasy, there's something in there for you.
And they're not just random picks. You get bingeable, can't stop reading stories with new chapters and new series every week.
It's become my go-to for winding down at the end of the day. Now, Scott, remind people what Galatea is again.
Galatea is a reading app where anyone craving a little me time can dive into a library of romance stories that leave you feeling recharged and fulfilled.
Right now, Galatea is offering our listeners an extra 25% off on top of an already irresistibly affordable subscription when you go to Galatea.com/COTC.
That's Galatea.com/COTC to indulge in unlimited stories for even less.
Galatea.com/COTC. To understand why Danny Hansford's death and Jim Williams's trials became such a fixation, you have to understand Savannah. Not the Savannah of postcards and ghost tours, but the real city beneath the Spanish moss and wrought iron balconies. Because Savannah isn't just incidental to this story, it's one of its main characters. It's a place where charm and control, beauty and brutality have always existed side by side. Savannah was founded in 1733 by British General James Oglethorpe, the same man who designed the Georgia colony. Oglethorpe had a vision for the city that was forged from his own experience touring debtors' prisons, from a documentary called Settling America, the Georgia Colony.
Oglethorpe became particularly focused upon the chaotic conditions in debtors' prisons when a friend of his died in one of them. That prompted him to propose, design, and found a utopian experiment for the worthy poor, those whose poverty stemmed from misfortune as opposed to some dramatic moral failing.
His idea was that people down on their luck, debtors, artisans, religious minorities, could thrive in a place built on structure, sobriety, and small-scale agrarian life. He banned slavery, liquor, and oversized landholdings, envisioning a community where industriousness and moral fortitude would win out over vice and corruption. The experiment didn't last.
An opposition group known as the Malcontents emerged with support from certain South Carolinians who slyly undercut Oglethorpe's model by renting out slaves to Georgians. The malcontents, most of whom had come to Georgia after the founding and had no loyalty to the trustees, complained that the ban on slavery and liquor, as well as the limits on property, meant that Georgians would never grow truly rich.
The malcontents chipped away at Oglethorpe's vision until Georgia looked a lot more like its southern neighbors, rich in cotton, brutal in labor, and rigid in hierarchy. But Oglethorpe's mark on Savannah never fully disappeared. He laid out the city in a deliberate grid of tree-lined public squares, for beauty, of course, but also for order, security, and shared purpose. That plan still defines the city's historic district today. And if you understand how the city was designed, with everyone in their place, everything neatly parceled out, you begin to understand how deep the impulse runs here to keep things looking tidy, even when they aren't. Savannah was Georgia's first city, its first capital, and quickly became a hub of shipping, cotton, and wealth built through the labor of enslaved people. Then came the Civil War. As Union General William Tecumseh Sherman burned his way across Georgia, he spared Savannah. Some say it was because the city surrendered peacefully. Others say it was because he found it too beautiful to destroy. Whatever the reason, Sherman wired President Abraham Lincoln to present Savannah, with its guns, its cotton, and its undamaged buildings, as a Christmas gift. That gift became a cornerstone of Savannah's identity. While other southern cities rebuilt from ashes, Savannah was preserved. Its architecture, its gardens, even its ghosts, all became part of the city's mythology. And for generations, that mythology was protected by layers of unspoken rules. Who you were, who your people were, how you behaved in public, and what you kept behind closed doors. Outsiders were tolerated, sometimes even welcomed, but only if they understood their place. Efforts to improve Savannah from the outside often were viewed with suspicion, especially if they came with too much money, too much flash, or too little respect for the city's long memory. Even Jim Williams, for all his restoration work, wasn't immediately embraced by Savannah's preservation establishment. He liked to buy and sell homes on his own terms, and in a city that prized slow, quiet consensus, that made some people nervous. Still, for the most part, Jim Williams knew how to navigate that world. Quite an accomplishment, considering he didn't come from it. He grew up in Gordon, Georgia, the son of a barber and a bookkeeper, and moved to Savannah as a young man. But he built a reputation through restoration work, restoring rundown historic homes into showpieces. Over the years, he restored more than 30 properties, including the Mercer House, which became his personal residence and showroom. His Christmas parties were legendary. His collection of antiques was world-class. He dealt with governors and aristocrats. He knew how to impress, but he didn't always know how to endear. Williams could be charming, yes, but also exacting, arrogant, and unapologetically ambitious. He wasn't born into the social elite, and that mattered to some people. He hadn't married, and that raised eyebrows. He operated according to his own code, and in a city where conformity is prized, that made him stand out, not always in a good way. So when a young man named Danny Hansford was killed inside the Mercer House, the shock wasn't just about the death itself. It was about where it happened and who was involved. The house cracked open the pristine image Savannah liked to project. It brought tension and rumor to the surface, and it forced the city to confront uncomfortable questions about class, power, and justice in full public view. Over the course of four murder trials, Savannah found itself on the national stage, a city as much on trial as the man at its center. You know who wasn't center stage, though? The man who died. So let's take a step back and talk about the person at the heart of this story, the one whose name doesn't grace any book covers, Danny Hansford. If you ask five different people in Savannah who Danny was, you'll get five different answers. A troublemaker, a charmer, a lost cause, an unrealized artist, sometimes all of the above. Danny Lewis Hansford was born in 1960 and raised on the rougher edges of Savannah. He dropped out of school, bounced between jobs, and had several run-ins with police, mostly for things like public intoxication, disorderly conduct, or weapons charges. But those who knew him described him as a kid who was bright, talented, and, when he wanted to be, deeply loyal. At 21, he'd been working for antiques dealer Jim Williams for about 2 years, running errands and doing odd jobs around Mercer House. Their relationship was intense, volatile, and, though most of Savannah didn't know it at the time, occasionally romantic. Some days, Williams would show Danny off like a prized possession. Other days, they were screaming at each other across the grand rooms of the Mercer House. To Danny, that house must have seemed like another planet. This is Jerry Spence, one of Danny's friends, speaking in an A&E documentary called Midnight in Savannah.
You can't put someone in that element into that sort of situation. I mean, you're surrounded by Fabergé boxes and Italian Café de Monte and porcelain and things like that that, of course, he would not know of. He'd be more interested in where whose earrings there might be on the side of a table or whose socks are on the floor from the night before or something.
This is Miriam Center, a friend of Williams.
I don't think the house just strictly represented money to him. He didn't know the names of the antiques and how well things were or the real works of art, but he knew that it was money. And I think that was very appealing to him.
But Danny could be explosive. The phrase bull in a china shop came up more than once in my research. He was described as having fits of rage, once firing a gun into the floor of the Mercer house. Twice, he reportedly overdosed on drugs. Both of those times, Williams was said to have saved him. Elizabeth Richardson, a friend of Williams, said she was once visiting Mercer House when she walked into a room where Danny sat lounging in a chair.
Jim said to him, "Get up when ladies come in the house, in the room." And he leaped out of the chair and just went into a rage. I saw the most instant insanity in this boy's face. I mean, it was an insane, violent look. And he kicked the chair and walked out of the room in a huff. I turned to Jim and I said, "You know, you're on a collision course with this boy." I said, "He's either going to kill you or you're going to have to kill him."
That collision course came to a head on May 2nd, 1981. What exactly happened that night depends on which version you believe, but what's undisputed is that Jim Williams called police around 3 a.m. to report a shooting. Officers found Danny Hansford dead on the floor of Williams' study with three bullets in his body and a gun nearby. Here's coroner James Metz describing the scene as he saw it that night.
"Once we entered the foyer, as you can see, there was some disorder. There's a grandfather clock that's lying face down and fractured. There's a couch on its side, various debris about. But even though we're investigating a death scene, we couldn't help but be impressed by the taste and wealth exhibited in that home."
Williams told police that Danny had snapped. He said Danny had been playing video games when he flew into a rage, waving a Luger pistol, which, it's worth noting, was at the house because Williams collected World War II Nazi paraphernalia. Williams claimed he tried to calm Danny down, but Danny aimed and fired the gun at him, missing each time. Williams said he fired back three times. Danny died in the study, just steps from Williams' desk. But from the start, officials felt the story didn't quite add up. Williams said Danny fired first, but police tested for gunpowder residue on his hands and said they found none. The Luger was discovered beneath Danny's hand in a way that looked staged, and the angle of the bullet wounds didn't seem to square with a face-to-face confrontation. Assistant District Attorney Depesh Kirkland, who responded to the scene that morning, would later say that the forensic evidence made self-defense, quote, "scientifically impossible," end quote. The investigation moved quickly. Williams was taken into custody that same day and charged with murder on May 5th. While it was largely a local story, it did make the Metro section of the Atlanta Constitution under the headline, "Antique Dealer is Charged in Death." Forensic analysts scrutinized the placement of blood spatter, shell casings, and the body itself. Prosecutors built a narrative of deliberate staging, suggesting Williams may have moved Danny's body, planted the gun, and called police only once the scene looked just right. But while officials told the public the case was open and shut, in truth, things were not so simple. Williams was wealthy, well-connected, and had powerful legal representation. He posted a $25,000 bond and was back at the Mercer House within days, holding parties, restoring antiques, and moving through Savannah society as if nothing had happened. Meanwhile, the DA's office kept digging. Investigators collected statements from witnesses who knew both men. They gathered photos from the crime scene and hired experts to bolster their version of events. But already, cracks were forming in the case. Not so much in the evidence itself, but in how it had been handled. And some of the crime scene photos appeared to show bystanders walking through the room before it was fully processed. And defense attorneys would later suggest that key elements had been tampered with or improperly preserved. Still, the charges stood. Jim Williams would go on trial for murder. But for now, he was out on bail, still living in the house where Danny died, still polishing silver, planning restorations, and weighing who would be sent coveted invitations to his end-of-year Christmas party, pretending that he wasn't waiting for the legal storm that was about to begin. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Quince Bedding. I'd been hearing people rave about linen sheets forever, and I finally get it. I made the switch with Quince, and now I'm obsessed.
Yeah, I noticed you've been talking about sheets more than you've been talking about the weather lately, which, you know, with the heat wave is saying something.
Quince Bedding's sheets are light, breathable, and soft from day one. Ours are woven from 100% European flax, and they somehow feel both relaxed and pulled together. Perfect for those warmer nights when you just want to stay comfortable.
And they look good, too. The whole bedroom feels a little more finished now.
Quince has more than just the linen bedding. There are ultra plush duvets, quilts, pillows, and shams in premium fabrics like organic cotton, bamboo, and silk. It's all about upgrading your bed without paying luxury markups.
Because they cut out the middleman and work directly with top artisans, the quality is amazing, but the price isn't ridiculous.
Level up your bedding with Quince. You'll feel the difference right away. Go to quince.com/centuries for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/centuries to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/centuries.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
The investigation into Danny Hansford's death moved swiftly and not always cleanly. After the arrest, questions began to swirl. Was the Luger pistol actually found under Danny's body? Had it been moved? Had Danny's position shifted after death? And the fact that prosecutors charged Williams with murder was controversial. Williams' version of events, that Danny had pulled a gun on him first, seemed plausible to many. I mean, folks in town not only knew of Danny's reputation as a hothead, but they were well aware that Williams had bailed him out of several bad predicaments, including a crime charge that had just been leveled against Danny a month before his death. Didn't it make more sense for a man who had saved Danny's hide repeatedly to have killed him in self-defense rather than in cold blood? This is Jan Scutch, a former reporter with the Savannah Morning News.
I always thought the case was overcharged. There's no more than voluntary manslaughter.
Williams was certain that the murder charge was for show and it would be dropped down to voluntary manslaughter, if not dismissed outright. But police and prosecutors wouldn't be swayed. They believed they were building a case that pointed clearly to murder, not self-defense. Assistant DA Depp Kirkland would later say that forensic evidence undercut Williams' account at every turn. No gunpowder residue on Danny's hands, wounds at angles that didn't match Williams' story. One crime scene photograph even showed a chair leg resting on top of Danny's pant cuff, which police said was clear proof the whole scene had been staged. But this was never going to be a simple case of forensics, because Jim Williams wasn't just another defendant, and he wasn't about to rely on any old public defender. Instead, Williams hired Bobby Lee Cook, a courtroom legend in Georgia and beyond. Cook was known for defending seemingly impossible cases. He had represented more than 250 clients accused of murder and won acquittals in 90% of them. He once boasted that he had never lost a case he truly believed in, only the ones where he was, quote, doing someone a favor, end quote. To the people of Savannah, though, Cook might as well have walked in wearing a Yankees cap and carrying a bagel. He was from Somerville, a small town in northwest Georgia, but to Savannians, he was read as a big city outsider, urbane, slick, the kind of lawyer you'd hire if you were guilty and rich. Never mind that he came from the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains of the very same state. He might as well have been dubbed Perry Mason in a Stetson. And he wasn't naive about that. He knew local juries could be suspicious of out-of-towners, especially ones who looked like they thought they were smarter than everyone else. So he brought in a second chair, John Wright Jones, a local attorney with strong ties in the community and a convenient rivalry with Chatham County Prosecutor Spencer Lawton Jr. Jones had previously defended four U.S. Army Rangers accused of murdering a 33-year-old man in Columbus, Georgia, a man they claimed had propositioned them. Spencer Lawton was the prosecutor on that case. The jury had acquitted the Rangers on all counts. It was a huge blow to Lawton, who had just been elected to his post in 1980. Now, Lawton and Jones were squaring off again, this time with national media watching. The courtroom dynamic was combustible. A legendary defense lawyer viewed as an outsider, a case that had already fractured polite society into camps, and a young DA with something to prove. This is author John Berendt, whom we'll talk about much more later.
The district attorney, Spencer Lawton, was brand new at the job. He'd only had one trial, a murder trial before, and he'd lost that. So people were very skeptical of his abilities, and they were watching very closely. So he was really intent upon winning the case against Jim Williams. There were high stakes for him.
Now, it wasn't all just for show. He surely believed in the righteousness of the state's case and had little patience for what he saw as the defense's flash. Lawton viewed Jim Williams as a manipulator and Bobby Lee Cook as his high-priced weapon. And to him, this wasn't just about one man's guilt. It was about whether Savannah's justice system could still deliver accountability when power and privilege were on the line. The trial began in early 1982, less than a year after Danny Hansford's death. To say it drew a crowd would be a huge understatement. Spectators lined up for seats, journalists filled the press box, and a city that typically preferred to keep its scandals private, the Mercer House case was an unavoidable public spectacle. The prosecution argued that this was not a case of self-defense. It was a cold-blooded killing, staged to look like one. They theorized that Danny walked into the study and William shot him, then used another gun to fire bullets from where Danny fell toward Williams' desk. The crime scene, they argued, had been carefully manipulated before police were called. And it's worth noting that Williams waited 30 minutes after the killing before he called police. He called some other friends first. Now, the defense said this was all nonsense, that Danny had fired first. To bolster their theory, they pointed to a police report from the previous month. Remember how I said Danny had already fired a gun inside Mercer House once before? Well, that's when it supposedly happened. According to Williams, Danny had become rageful and unhinged. Williams called the police, who arrived and arrested Danny, who Williams claimed was pretending to be asleep in his bed. Amazingly, the two had patched things up afterward. I can't say I'd be so forgiving. During the trial, both sides brought in witnesses who described Danny's volatility and also his vulnerability. Jerry Spence again.
I personally liked Danny Hansford. I thought he was a nice young man. He had befriended me and was very nice to me. And I had a convertible at the time, and he used to stop by my place and ring the security buzzer and said, I think somebody's trying to break into your car and things like that.
So on one hand, jurors heard things like that, but then they also heard about the fights, the gunshots into the floor, the overdoses, the arguments, and it had to have had their heads spinning. Meanwhile, Cook emphasized Jim's calm demeanor when he called police. He hammered the lack of motive. Why would Williams, a man of means and reputation, risk everything to murder a volatile but largely powerless employee. But Lawton's case was tight, and his courtroom presence was compelling. He leaned into the idea that appearances could be deceiving, that genteel manners and antique furniture were no guarantee of innocence. He told the jury to look past the surface. And as for motive, well, he presented one for jurors to ponder. After pressing Williams on the nature of his relationship with Danny, Williams insisted the two were at most mentor-mentee in that regard, Lawton presented two rebuttal witnesses. They were friends of Danny's who testified that the men were lovers. This, remember, was 1982 in Georgia. Some of Williams' longtime friends were shocked. So was his elderly mother, who was in the courtroom supporting her beloved son. Lawton said Williams had motive to keep Danny Hansford quiet. Then, in his closing argument, Lawton went for the jugular by imparting a theory that circled back to that gun fired into the floor incident. Lawton suggested that maybe that had been staged. Maybe Danny hadn't been pretend sleeping after all. Maybe the whole thing was a diabolical setup, a dress rehearsal for the fatal shooting on May 2nd. In fact, Lawton said, the cops who investigated the April shooting didn't even think the bullet they found in the floor was fresh, meaning no gun had necessarily been fired in the house that night. Williams, he argued, might have randomly called the police, pointed to an old bullet hole, and pinned it on Danny. This was a bombshell. The jury deliberated for only a few hours before returning a verdict. Guilty of murder.
Good evening, I'm Frenchie Brewer. Prominent Savannah antique dealer James Williams was convicted of murder today in the shooting death of his friend Danny Hansford and was sentenced to life in prison. And the Savannah Metropolitan...
Jim Williams was stunned. So was much of Savannah. But if Spencer Lawton was celebrating, it didn't last long. Because Williams wasn't done yet. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Rula. I have a friend right now who's trying to find a therapist that takes her insurance, and it's been a nightmare.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest barriers to getting help. Even if you find someone, the cost can be a deal breaker.
That's why I told her about Rula. Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, so the average copay is just $15 per session. And depending on your benefits, it could be as little as $0.
And they don't just match you with the first random provider. They actually consider your goals, preferences, and background, so you get a curated list of licensed in-network therapists who are a real fit.
Plus, there's no wait list. You can find someone who's accepting new patients and book an appointment as soon as tomorrow. And Rula sticks with you throughout your journey, checking in to make sure your care is working for you.
Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit Rula.com/COTC to get started.
After you sign up, you'll be asked how you heard about them. Please support our show and let them know we sent you.
That's RULA.com/COTC. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Jim Williams had been convicted of murder, but the story was far from over. Not long after the verdict, Williams' legal team filed a motion for a new trial. They argued that the first trial had been tainted by prosecutorial overreach, particularly in Spencer Lawton's closing argument when he introduced the brand new theory that Williams had fabricated the earlier incident in which Danny had supposedly fired a gun into the floor at Mercer House. According to Lawton, Williams had faked the earlier outburst to lay the groundwork for a self-defense claim later, a move that cast doubt on Williams' entire account of Danny's behavior. But here's the problem. That theory hadn't been raised during the trial itself. It had been presented in evidence, argued by witnesses, or addressed in testimony, so the defense had no chance to challenge it. They couldn't cross-examine anyone about it or present evidence to rebut it because Lawton had sprung it in his closing argument when it was too late for a response. Now, this was compelling enough that Williams was released straight away on a $200,000 bond pending appeal, an almost unheard-of concession in a first-degree murder case. But the judge's caution proved prescient. The Georgia Supreme Court indeed found the prosecution's closing argument deeply problematic. Even worse, it found that prosecutors presented that last-minute theory while actually withholding a portion of a police report that supported Williams' version of events about the incident. Corporal M.J. Anderson had responded to the April shooting and had filed a report at the time stating that the bullet hole in the floor was fresh, backing up Williams' claim that Danny had fired a gun in the house. But the officer testified at the murder trial that he hadn't been able to tell whether the bullet hole was fresh, and the defense wasn't told that he had initially said otherwise. The GA Supremes ruled that this concealment of exculpatory evidence violated Williams' right to a fair trial. So, in January of 1983, it overturned Williams' conviction and granted him a new trial. A side note, I found a news story about this ruling, and Williams' case was only one of six weighed by the court to be overturned. This was not a soft court. As Williams awaited his second trial, he told anyone who would listen that behind the scenes, the prosecution's case was quickly unraveling. He was certain trial number two would go his way, if it even happened at all. Meanwhile, Williams was living life like he wasn't facing trial anyway, outwardly, at least. When one reporter asked him if things would be business as usual, he replied, "Damn right." He was back selling antiques and even traveling afar with the court's permission to make big purchases. His reputation naturally took a hit with some folks, though that mostly only happened with people who hadn't really liked him to begin with. For example, he had long been at odds with a neighbor named Lee Adler and his wife Emma, both high-profile historic preservationists. Here's Emma talking about the couple's preservation efforts.
I mean, we knew, we were in the national limelight, setting the pace for historic preservation in the country.
And that was kind of the Adlers' thing, talking about themselves like they were the only ones doing preservationist things, which is why Williams didn't like them much. Before Hansford's death, though, the rivals played nice for the cameras. Afterwards, not so much. Lee Adler was a huge financial supporter of Spencer Lawton, the prosecutor going after Williams. Now, the team behind Williams was changing. Bobby Lee Cook, who had defended Williams in the first trial, stepped aside, reportedly due to the grueling travel and the enormous time commitment of defending a high-profile client in Savannah. In his place, Williams brought in a new lead attorney, Frank Sonny Seiler. If Bobby Lee Cook had been seen as a big city outsider, Sonny Seiler was Savannah royalty. Seiler wasn't just a respected attorney, he was a fixture of Savannah society. He'd represented powerful clients, hosted lavish events, and was best known beyond the courtroom as the longtime owner of the University of Georgia's beloved live mascot, Uga the Bulldog. Well, technically, at the time of the second trial, he was owner of Uga number 3. We're on to Uga number 11 right now. Anyway, Seiler had deep roots in Georgia. He earned his bachelor's and law degrees from UGA in the 1950s and quickly became a prominent figure in both Savannah's legal circles and its social scene. As someone who had lived his entire adult life navigating Savannah's unwritten rules, Seiler was the perfect counterweight to the outsider image that had plagued Cook. Where Cook had seemed slick, Seiler was smooth. Where Cook seemed distant, Seiler felt familiar. That familiarity was key. The case had divided Savannah, and Williams needed someone who could bridge those divides. Someone who didn't just understand the city, but was the city. Arthur Berendt again.
He's brilliant, and he can assemble an argument that can persuade anybody.
Also, in court, he's very compelling. The jurors liked him. They trusted him. This is important for a defense lawyer to manage.
The second trial began in September 1983. Many of the key facts remained unchanged. The prosecution again emphasized the lack of gunpowder residue on Danny's hands, the blood evidence, the questionable position of the Luger pistol. They again suggested the crime scene had been manipulated. But this time, the defense sharpened its strategy. Seiler headed off the matter of Williams' relationship with Danny, having Williams himself characterize it on the stand as a romantic one. It's worth noting that Williams insisted that his sister escort his mother out of the courtroom for this testimony. Seiler argued powerfully that the shooting was entirely done in self-defense because Danny had snapped. Here he is explaining.
He'd gone on a tirade, and it was just so much of that that Jim was going to take. But the evidence showed that that Hansford grabbed him and threw him up against the wall and threatened to shoot him, came in the room with the pistol. I mean, what you going to do?
The jury didn't buy it. On September 21st, 1983, Jim Williams was convicted of murder for a second time. He was again sentenced to life in prison. Seiler was floored. He told friends afterward that he believed he had truly won that trial, but the jury had been swayed by emotion or confusion or loyalty to their local police department. They had certainly not been swayed by the evidence, he said. Williams also was stunned. And this time, he couldn't lick his wounds at home. He was sent to prison as he and Sonny began mounting yet another appeal. And prison was a grueling environment for Williams, who was so used to refinement. He was placed in a block with seven other gay inmates, kept separate from Gen Pop. Correctional Officer Lieutenant Herb Harley recalls of Williams.
He was always neat, well-groomed. His uniform was always pressed and neat. He had that dark hair with gray in temples, looked very distinguished, smoked cigars. He played chess. He'd teach the other inmates how to play chess. But then you'd have the other inmates in here be dressed up in outfits they would make out of their sheets. Mini skirts, halter tops, screaming, carrying on, trying to provoke officers and their other inmates. And it was quite a contrast.
It took 22 long months, but Williams and Seiler again won their appeal, this time on the grounds that the judge inappropriately allowed a Savannah police detective to testify as an expert for the prosecution, and also for again introducing new evidence in his closing argument. This time it was related to the trigger on the gun Hansford had supposedly used to shoot at Williams. Lawton waited until his closing to demonstrate that it wasn't nearly as hard a trigger to pull as the defense had said during the trial. The ruling was a razor-thin 4-3 decision. Spencer Lawton immediately started getting ready for trial number 3. The Centuries is sponsored by Cornbread Hemp. I've had a heck of a time sleeping this past week, and I finally figured out why. School's about to start again for Hunt and for me, and apparently my brain thinks 2 a.m. is the perfect time to stress about it.
Which is why you'll be reaching for Cornbread Hemp CBD gummies again, right?
Exactly. They're made to help you feel better, whether it's stress, discomfort, or just needing a little relaxation. My favorites are the watermelon and peach flavors, and they only use the best part of the hemp plant, the flower, for the purest, most potent CBD.
And no junk. Everything's USDA organic and third-party lab tested for safety and purity. Plus, Cornbread Hemp has those seltzers we straight up love, so that's always a bonus when we place an order.
Right now, Crimes of the Centuries listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/COTC and use code COTC at checkout.
That's cornbreadhemp.com/COTC and use code COTC.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
By the time Jim Williams' third trial rolled around in 1987, lawyer Sonny Seiler had grown increasingly frustrated with the one thing he couldn't out-argue, the city of Savannah itself. Seiler had requested a change of venue, arguing that his client couldn't possibly get a fair shake in a town where everyone had an opinion or thought they had a stake in the outcome. But the request was denied. Once again, the trial would unfold under the fragrant magnolia trees and side eyes of Savannah. The prosecution's case was largely unchanged. Lawton stuck with the same core points: that William had orchestrated the crime scene, that Danny Hansford hadn't fired a gun, and that the lack of gunpowder residue on Danny's hands undermined the whole self-defense theory. That last part had been key in both prior convictions. And why wouldn't Lawton lead on it again? It had worked twice. But Seiler came armed with something new. While reviewing case documents, his team unearthed a crucial hospital record that had been withheld by the prosecution in not one, but two previous trials. It was a hospital admitting form filled out by the nurse in charge of the emergency room. She'd written, quote, "Hands bagged bilaterally in emergency department," end quote. Seiler tracked the nurse down and asked what the notation meant. She said it meant just what it said, that she had put bags over both of Danny's hands so any gunpowder on them wouldn't rub off. It wasn't something she typically did, she explained, but the coroner had called and told her to do it. And this was explosive. Author Berendt.
So putting him, wrapping him in a blanket and putting him on the gurney and taking him into the hearse and over to the hospital, got my hands bumped around and possibly could have wiped off all the residue.
Even more damning, speaking to the nurses and experience with handbagging, she hadn't used standard paper evidence bags. She had used plastic. Now that might not sound like a bombshell, but in the world of forensics, it's huge. Plastic bags trap moisture, and moisture destroys gunpowder residue. The very thing prosecutors had used, twice, to convince juries that Danny Hansford hadn't fired a gun might have been invalid from the start. To be clear, Lawton had repeatedly claimed in two trials that Hansford never fired a shot, and the state's experts backed that up based on the supposed presence or absence of gunpowder residue. But the whole premise depended on Hansford's hands having been preserved properly at the scene. They weren't. And Lawton had the documentation all along. He just didn't hand it over. TV reporter Nancy Amons.
The DA was blown away. He was speechless. I think I saw the color drain out of his face. I interviewed him live a few minutes later, and I asked, "Did you know about this witness? Did you know about this report?" And he said, "No, I had no idea." Surprises like that almost never really happen in the courtroom, but this was the cannon shot that blew a hole in the whole state's case.
Now, for the record, all of this has me shaking my head that Lawton ultimately served 28 years in the DA post. I mean, I'm sure he has his fans out there, but this wasn't a great start to his tenure. He seemed to have a pattern: hide anything that might weaken the state's narrative, and sandbag the defense with new claims and closing arguments where rebuttal is impossible. It's the kind of conduct that gets cases overturned, as this one had twice already, and the kind of thing that leads to wrongful convictions. And yet, jury number 3 still didn't acquit. 11 jurors were ready to convict, one held out. The result was a mistrial. Now, at this point, you'd think the prosecution might take a breath. Two overturned convictions, one mistrial, a paper trail of withheld evidence. I mean, most DAs would decide, maybe I should stop spending taxpayers' money to get this conviction my ego so desperately wants. But Spencer Lawton wasn't most DAs. He still believed he could win, And to give him some credit here, I'll go ahead and assume it's because he truly believed Williams was guilty. So, for the fourth time, he prepared to prosecute Jim Williams for murder. This time, the trial was moved, finally, to Augusta, Georgia, away from Savannah, away from the swirl of social politics and preservationist rivalries, away from the courthouse Williams had walked in and out of so many times, they may as well have installed a revolving door. Sonny Seiler once again led the defense, and this time he didn't have to fight the city just to get a fair hearing. No ghost tours circled the Mercer House. No reporters lingered on the courthouse steps like moss clinging to stone. This trial was about evidence. Once the evidence was all the jury had to go on, it didn't take long. They acquitted Jim Williams in less than an hour. Just like that, it was over. 8 years, 4 trials, and a murder charge that had consumed every corner of Williams' life. He walked out of that courtroom a free man for the final time. But while Williams regained his freedom, the trials had taken a toll. His health was fading. His reputation, while partially restored, would always be shadowed by the drama of those years. And the Mercer House, once his showpiece, had become as much of a crime scene in the public imagination as a monument to preservation. Within 8 months, Jim Williams was dead. Despite the rumors that immediately swirled, was he murdered for his role in Danny's death? The cause of death was much more pedantic. Pneumonia. His mother, who had stood by his side through 4 grueling trials, had told reporters after his acquittal that the good Lord could take her from this mortal plane whenever he saw fit. It seems almost cruel she outlived her son. Now, I'm sure you all have heard about the book based on this case. It's called Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil by John Barrett. I read it while traveling to Savannah to do this research. I even toured the crime scene, now called the Mercer Williams House. I'd share recordings of the tour, but...
There's no photography or recording once we go through this door, and if you could silence your cell phone.
I loved the tour, though. The house is amazing, and it's in the midst of another renovation, this time spearheaded by Williams' sister, who lives there. The book looms large over the city, even 30-plus years after its publication. It came out in 1994 and was soon followed by a Clint Eastwood-directed movie of the same name. Both the book and film made celebrities of a number of Savannah characters, people like Lady Chablis, a real person who portrayed herself in the movie.
John Barron made me a promise when he wrote that book. He says, you're going to be famous, and he kept his promise.
In truth, Lady Chablis had nothing to do with a criminal case. And while John Barron inserts himself as a character in the unfolding story, he didn't actually come to Savannah until well after Danny Hansford's murder. In short, Midnight wasn't really about facts. It was about the feeling of Savannah, the allure, the gossip, the double lives and secret loyalties that simmered just beneath the surface. For all its embellishments and omissions, the book did capture something essential, that in Savannah, truth is often stranger than fiction, and fiction is often more polite than truth. What gets lost, though, in all the Southern Gothic charm and quirky characters, is the very real story of a 21-year-old whose life was cut short by a man who stood trial 4 times for the same crime, and of a prosecution team that bent the rules again and again to make a conviction stick. Neither Danny Hansford nor Jim Williams was perfect, but neither was the system itself. And if this case reminds us of anything, it's that justice isn't just about guilt or innocence, it's about the process. And when prosecutors put their pride ahead of fairness, everyone loses. Even now, decades later, the Mercer Williams House draws tourists, like my partner Scott and me, with tales of murder and mystery. But beyond those velvet ropes and shadowy parlor rooms lies a deeper truth, one that's harder to sell in a souvenir shop, that the most chilling part of this story wasn't the killing, it was what came after.
Music.
To research this case, I indeed went to Savannah, Georgia, while reading Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil by John Berendt. That is a narrative nonfiction, so parts are heavily fictionalized, some people are given pseudonyms, and Berendt wasn't really there before the murder. As such, I had to fact-check like crazy using contemporary news reports and court documents. Luckily, A&E released the Midnight in Savannah program about the case in 1997 to promote Clint Eastwood's movie, so a number of the external soundbites come from there. I need to note, though, that some of the fake parts of the book are repeated in that quote-unquote documentary, so if you find it online, keep that in mind. If you've read the book, you'll remember the character Minerva. She was loosely based on a woman named Valerie Bowles, and while Bowles was a root doctor and was helpful to Williams during his trials, the real story wasn't quite as mystical as the book and movie made it seem. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.